Sometimes you hear the teaching on not self presented as a question of formal logic. You start with the premise that a self, to qualify as a self, has to mean permanent self. And the second premise is you look at what you are, and you are just five aggregates: form, feeling, perceptions, thought constructs, consciousness, all of which are impermanent. And there's the conclusion. Therefore, you don't have a self. Now, it's worth noting that the Buddha himself never used this argument. It started later in the commentaries. After all, he admitted that in his time, many different versions of self were taught, and not all of them were permanent, even in the Upanishads, which we tend to think teach nothing but a permanent self, a cosmic self. Actually, there are many ideas of Upanishadic self that are impermanent. So if the Buddha was going to limit the meaning of self to permanent self, he would have had to explain why. He never did. Sometimes we're told that there's a passage in the canon where the Buddha says the I is not self because the arising of the eye can be seen, and the passing away of the eye can be seen. He applies this to all the six senses, the objects of the senses, contact at the senses, consciousness at the senses. You can see these things arise, you can see them pass away. Therefore, they're not self. And the conclusion is then drawn, well, this means that for the Buddha, self must have meant permanent self. But that's not the case. If you see something arise, it just can't be yourself. Whether you believe in an impermanent self or a permanent self, connected, unconnected, separate. If you see something arise, it can't be you. You see something pass away, it can't be you, because you're there to see it arise, you're there to see it pass away. We have to note that the Buddha never made a distinction between your sense of self and your sense of what you are. Self comes down to the belief, I am this. And they can apply to all kinds of things. The main problem, though, with this interpretation is it really limits the force of the not-self teaching. It applies only to an idea as a permanent self. But what if you have an idea of an impermanent self? Are you still supposed to hold on to that? Are you still supposed to cling to that idea? And is there something special about the idea of a permanent self that makes it a lot more conducive to suffering than an impermanent self? When dogs are suffering, are they suffering because of the idea of a permanent self? I've heard people say that when you realize that there is no permanent self, that puts it into suffering, that the cause of suffering is an idea of permanent self. Ask dogs. Ask little children who don't know any language. They suffer. Certainly not because they have an idea of permanent self. So by limiting self, atta, to mean permanent self, you limit the power of the not-self teaching. It can't do away with all forms of suffering that relate to ideas of self. Now, there is an alternative way of looking at the logic of not-self, but it depends on a different kind of logic entirely. As the Buddha noted, even though he would say many, many times, the aggregates are in constant, stressful, not self. He did admit that they do have their pleasurable side. As he said, if they didn't have that pleasurable side, we wouldn't have passion for them. We wouldn't delight in them. Now, passion and delight, that's the definition of clinging. And one of the ways we cling is to our ideas of self. We create a sense of self around the aggregates, either identifying directly with the aggregates or believing that we own the aggregates, or that we are in the aggregates, or the aggregates are in us. In other words, you may decide that you are your consciousness. Consciousness may be impersonal, but you can still identify with it, have a sense of self around it, even if you don't define it as a person. You may sense that you own the aggregates, in which case you might be a permanent owner or an impermanent owner. The idea of being in the aggregates, You think of your consciousness as being in the body. Or the aggregates may be in you. You may have a sense of a cosmic consciousness which contains the aggregates. These are different ways in which we define ourselves. They can be permanent or impermanent. But we identify because we get some pleasure out of the aggregates. We see that it's worthwhile to identify with them. And this precisely is what the not-self teaching is calling into question. Are they really worth identifying with? Now, as you're on the path, you actually use the aggregates to create the pleasure of concentration and the pleasure that comes with following the precepts, getting the mind concentrated. There's even pleasure in discernment. And there's an extent to which you do have to create a sense of self around this. This is why we have the saying the self is its own mainstay. Where the Buddha says you have self as a governing principle. And if you're tempted to fall away from the path, you remind yourself that you loved yourself. You wanted to put an end to suffering. If you give up now, do you not love yourself anymore? So the sense of self does have its positive uses. There really is pleasure that comes from this, especially when you master the skills of concentration. When you tell yourself, I can do this, and I'm going to enjoy this. That's part of our motivation for even for taking on the teaching on not-self, as the Buddha said. Let go of what's not yours. That would be for your long-term welfare and happiness. So this is an extent to which the aggregates do provide pleasure, even on the path. Why you shouldn't reject them. You shouldn't try to do away with your sense of self before it's showed how useful it can be. But then there will come a point. You've gotten the mind as still as you can manage, at peace as you can manage, at peace as best you can manage. And there'll still be a sense of dissatisfaction because there's something that is fabricated, something you have to put together. And this is where you have to think about the Third Noble Truth. The Buddha is saying there is the cessation of suffering, total cessation of suffering, the ultimate happiness that comes from letting go. In the context of that truth, then you can apply the perception of not-self even to the skills you've developed as a meditator. Now notice this teaching on not-self, and the logic in this case is you are held on because these things provided you with pleasure, but then you realize that holding on is getting in the way of the greater pleasure. That's the logic. But the logic works only in the context of the Third Noble Truth. Without that Third Noble Truth, you might tell yourself, well, even though this is fabricated, it has to be maintained. Still, this is the best there is, so I might as well hold on. But when the Buddha says, by letting go, by developing dispassion for these things, there's an even greater happiness. So that's the logic of not-self. It's not a question of formal logic. It more has to do with the logic of your desire for happiness and your sense of what's worth doing in quest of that happiness. So it's best to understand the teaching on not-self in this way, because then it can apply to any way that you might cling to any sense of self, permanent, impermanent, connected, separate, whatever. The Buddha was thorough. He saw clinging in all of its forms and taught us to see in ourselves clinging in all of its possible forms. And then use this logic, the logic of wanting to find the ultimate happiness, get past all that clinging. When there's no more clinging, there's no more suffering. That's where this path is headed.